Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. After dozens of colleges and universities were subject to a federal investigation over the past year into how they handled sexual assault allegations, some are changing the way they deal with sexual violence on campus. Here with me now to talk about some of the changes at colleges in our area, especially the huge network of SUNY schools, is Capital New York's education reporter Jessica Bakeman. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So before we get to some of the changes to how SUNY schools handle sexual assault allegations, what prompted all of this?
So the federal government did an investigation of 159 individual cases of alleged sexual harassment at actually four SUNY campuses, and that review began in December 2010. And they found through that investigation what they called a sexually hostile environment on some of those campuses. And so they worked with SUNY to come up with an agreement where SUNY agreed to improve its compliance with Title IX, which is, of course, the landmark law that prohibits gender-based discrimination at educational institutions that receive federal assistance. So some of those provisions have to do with sexual assault. And the agreement was finalized in November 2013. Now, SUNY officials argue that the university system was singled out for the investigation, not because of any egregious examples of sexual harassment or sexual assault, but because the public university system is so big. It is, in fact, the largest public university system in the country with more than 460,000 students. So through that agreement, SUNY agreed to have to designate a Title IX compliance officer at each of its 29 state-operated campuses, which is all of the schools aside from the community colleges, which are partially controlled by local governments. And so I wanted to check up with some of the colleges and find out any specific changes that they have made in terms of how they deal with incidents of sexual assault and also how they hope to prevent those from happening at individual campuses.
And before we get to that, you said that the federal government found a sexually hostile environment at SUNY schools. What does that mean?
Well, you know, they didn't go into much more detail in the report. I would imagine that that meant they investigated those incidents at the four campuses, which were Buffalo State, SUNY Albany, New Paltz, and Mooresville. And they found that there were problems in the way that those campuses had dealt with the incidents of sexual assault there.
And of course, there's a widely cited sobering statistic that one in five undergraduate women will be sexually assaulted while on
right.
campus. And of course, not all we assume that not all are reported as well. There have been lots of stories, too, of schools that seem to really bungle investigations, internal investigations. I'm thinking in particular of the one at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in New York earlier this year, right?
Yes, there was this explosive New York Times piece that gave a look that is rare. You don't typically get to see all of the details of how these incidents play out on a college campus, since so much of it happens internally and there's so much confidentiality laws that are involved. So this New York Times piece really gave a look at how this situation was handled, and it was very critical of how the internal investigation went. The victim, who is identified in the story by the name of Anna, testifies, and they also, had documents that they looked through that showed that she didn't have all the resources that she should have had, that she didn't have all the information she should have had going through the internal process. And it was something that was handled internally by the college instead of by local law enforcement.
So what are some of the changes that SUNY announced in how it's going to handle sexual assault allegations on its many campuses?
Well, I'll start with SUNY Binghamton because in May, actually, as a part of an overall federal effort to improve how colleges respond to sexual assaults, the federal government, specifically the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, released a list of colleges nationwide that the federal government is investigating for possible Title IX violations. And that was the first time the federal government had ever done that. And they said that it was, you know, an effort to increase transparency around this. So SUNY Binghamton actually was on the original list that was released in May, along with CUNY Hunter, Sarah Lawrence College in Westchester, and one other that is escaping me right now. But so Binghamton actually ended up being cleared when an updated list came out later because they were a part of the SUNY-wide agreement and said that they would make changes. Oh, of course, Hobart and William Smith was the other one that was on the, that first list. Binghamton, one thing that they did was change the standard of evidence necessary to decide, you know, an alleged person who is accused of sexual assault to decide their guilt. So they used before the clear and convincing evidence standard, and now they're going to use the preponderance of evidence standard, which means the decision would be based on what the majority of evidence suggests. So it's a lower standard of proof, and that's what is suggested by the federal government. They also allow now both the victim and accused to have an advisor present at their hearings, and they plan to hire some new staff members to, instead of having, you know, maybe someone in the health center and someone in the psychological services center and someone who deals with alcohol and drug abuse, which often can be connected to sexual assault. Instead of having those separate, they're hiring someone to oversee and have a coordinated, more comprehensive team to address issues of sexual assault.
We're talking with Jessica Bakeman. She's Capital New York's education reporter. I'm Isaac D.V. Aronson in for Brian Lehrer, and this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And listeners, we want to know what you think about some of these changes to sexual assault investigation policies at schools in our area. Have you or some when you know had an experience with this at your school, good or bad, give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Jessica, what we haven't addressed yet is why the schools have been so slow to make these changes. Some of them seem so obvious, like the administrators handling these cases should be highly trained. I mean, why are they seemingly dragging their feet on this?
Well, when I called a lot of the SUNY schools to find out, you know, what changes they might have made since the November Title IX agreement, many of them said that the guidance from the federal government were things that they had already had in place for many years, that they had already been dealing with sexual assault cases in the ways that the federal government had suggested. For example, like what I just mentioned, a lot of the schools already had those standards of proof and letting the victims and the accused have advisors, et cetera. But I also think that there's been a lot of national attention on this issue, one, because it has been a focus of the White House and the federal government, and, you know, because, as you said, there have been these egregious stories of incidents where sexual assaults were not handled properly. You know, I think the New York Times story was one that got a lot of attention, but it certainly wasn't the first. There were many stories before that put attention on this issue. So I'm not sure exactly when a lot of these campuses started to make these changes, but I think with all of the national attention over the last several years, I don't think there's a university or college that's not looking at this now.
We want to look at a private institution as well, Columbia Columbia University here in New York has also made some big changes to its policy following the federal guidelines. And a statement from the president of Columbia, Lee Bollinger, says, quote, "Our goals underlying the new policy are principally these: to strengthen confidence in the university's handling of reports of sexual assault and other gender-based misconduct, to ensure fairness for all parties involved, and to provide more assistance to students in need," unquote. Some of the changes, they've removed students from the hearing panels for sexual assault investigations. They'll now allow lawyers to come to hearings, and they're hiring several more trained administrators. I want to bring in a Columbia student and a member of the group No Red Tape Columbia, Michaela Weil. She's on the phone to talk about some of these changes. Hi, Michaela. Welcome to WNYC.
Having me.
What do you and some of the members of your group think about the changes to Columbia's policy?
So there's a lot that we think. It's a long policy, as you've seen, and I think there's some really good things coming out of it and some that we're still pretty frustrated with. I think to start with, it's really important to emphasize that overall the way this was brought about is not okay. There's been student activism going on campus for months trying to push for new policies, part of that activism being an entirely rewritten policy of what we wanted to see at the school, and administrators have pretty much entirely refused to meet with us or consider that, and then went behind the back of people who that policy, previous policy, had failed to create a new policy. And so that is creating a lot of frustration. But at the same time, going back to what's good about the policy, this what you mentioned about having lawyers in the room is really important. That's largely due to a mandate by the Campus Save Act, which is a piece of legislation that deals with sexual assault on campus, but it is a good thing that we're happy to see. And in addition, another small piece that's changed is that they're now having, there's a piece that says there's mandatory re-education for about consent for anyone that's been found responsible of sexual assault or harassment. So that's huge. That's something that activists have been pushing for months, and we're really, really excited to see that it actually happened. On the other hand, there are some pieces that are still really lacking. One of the biggest ones is that the deans of the schools, of the respondent school, so the person who's being tried, are still the ones responsible for making sanctioning and appeals decisions, which is a huge conflict of interest, right? The deans of the student school are the ones, you know, most invested in making sure that that student has a positive experience at school and that that school itself maintains a positive image, and so that that is not going to lead to a school that serves students' needs, as President Bollinger's statement suggests.
And I actually just
those are some key pieces.
Yeah, yes. And I want to jump in on that point about the university, you know, handling it itself. I want to take a call from David in Harrison, New York, who has a question about that. David, thanks for calling.
Hi. My thought was I don't think the university should be involved at all with these things. They should, if there's a physical problem, you know, somebody was hurt physically, you call 911, and then the local police should take over. And this way to remove, make everything transparent. Because otherwise it's a conflict of interest. They're trying to protect their image as a school. And I don't see why this hasn't been brought out before. It's like a no-brainer. You have police that are trained. You know, you have women police officers who can go in 1, 2, 3, take the right statements, get the right help, psychiatric, whatever. And the school should not have anything to do with it other than calling 911.
David, thanks so much for your call and making that point. Jessica Bakeman with Capital New York, I wonder about, you know, your thoughts on that. I mean, I think certainly one issue would seem to be that I think that people haven't necessarily had great experiences going to the police either.
Yes, I mean, many reports we've seen where the police haven't handled the situations well either. I know existing federal law allows the victim or the person reporting a crime to make that decision, whether they choose to deal with it internally with the university or with the local police, or in many situations they do both, which an advocate for students who are experiencing sexual assault told me that sometimes it makes sense to do both, because while you want to have the local police involved for a criminal investigation, sometimes that doesn't go fast enough to solve some of the issues that you experience at school. For example, if the person that you're accusing of sexual assault is in your classes or lives in your dormitory, that's not something that the police can handle. That's something that the school has to handle if they're going to make sure that, you know, you feel safe and you aren't in the presence of that person throughout the adjudication process or throughout the criminal investigation.
Michaela Weil at Columbia, one thing I want to ask you is I graduated from Columbia just over a dozen years ago, and during my time there, this exact, almost exact conversation was happening. And I knew several people who lobbied for changes to the sexual misconduct and sexual assault policy, sat down with administrators, rewrote the policy, and here we are a dozen years later at the same point. What's so intractable about this?
That's a really good question, and I think it's something that we're all trying to figure out, and we're all trying to figure out how to change, because part of what's inherent to student activism and change on schools is that there's this constant turnover, right? Especially of students. Every 4 years, there's a huge group that graduates, but even of teachers, they don't stay around as long as in some other jobs, so you don't have this institutional memory that you do in, like, the federal government when you're changing laws, and there's sort of this more linear push forward, right? We have this weird cycle going on. And I think what could help change that is having stronger measures in place to make sure that the system is checking itself. Right now, all that happens is a new policy gets written every decade or so, and we just hope that it continues to work. And that's not how any kind of policy works, right? It's constantly being rewritten and revised to adapt to changing ways of thinking about things or realizing that parts of it didn't actually work as well as we expected them to. So what we need is, in that policy itself, a mechanism to make sure that student input is constantly being accepted and the administration is constantly making sure that the policy is doing what it needs to be doing for the students it's trying to serve.
And I want to note that tomorrow on the program we'll have Suzanne Goldberg on the show to talk in more detail about the policy changes at Columbia. She's Columbia University's special advisor to President Bollinger on sexual assault prevention and response, as well as a Columbia Law School professor. I want to bring in William in Watchung, New Jersey, who has a great question. William, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I was actually a student at Hobart Lanisterth Colleges. I spoke to Anna after the article came out through a friend that I knew. And I actually also had a good friend of mine who was sexually assaulted on campus and saw the failure of the system at the colleges to really, first of all, protect the student herself. And in following up with that, just having a fair trial. So I have two questions to bring up to the resident expert. Is what are the incentives of the schools to protect the assailants? And second, the role of this lawyer / consultant Brett Sokolo, who does consulting for Yale and all these colleges that have had issues with sexual assault. So I guess what is his role in all of this?
William, thanks so much for your call. Jessica Bakeman with Capital New York. I want to throw that question, the first part of William's question, to you first. Do the colleges? Is there a sense that the colleges have an interest in protecting the alleged assailants?
Well, I mean, I think the answer to that question is obvious in that colleges have an interest in protecting their image. They want students to continue to come there. They want students and their parents to see that college as a safe place to go. And so if they have many public incidents of violent crimes on campus, people aren't going to want to go there. I think that's probably the most obvious thing. But as we've seen with some legislative proposals that have come up on the state level and the federal level, lawmakers are trying to create disincentives to protecting the assailant. They're trying to increase penalties for violating Title IX or violating the Clery Act, which is a law that requires colleges to report crimes on campus, to make it so that those colleges could potentially lose federal funding or face higher fines if they don't handle these situations properly.
Michaela Weil at Columbia, What specifically do No Red Tape and other groups at Columbia and Barnard that are part of the Coalition Against Sexual Violence, you know, want to see happen? Were there specific things that you wanted to see in this policy, the policy changes at Columbia that you didn't see?
Yeah, there's a number. So I already mentioned the deans making sanctioning decisions. I think, as the person who called in earlier mentioned, it's easy to think that schools should just stop handling this and the police should do it instead. And there's a lot of reasons why, actually, I don't believe, and the various groups I'm involved in don't believe that's the right answer. But it's very clear that the people making decisions right now are way too biased and to make fair decisions. So we need parties making those decisions that are as impartial as you can get while still working for the university. And then, in addition, this is actually a really interesting small change, and this is not at all representative, but one of the many things we hope to see is that currently, as the policy stood before, evidence from previous cases couldn't be used as evidence in new cases, even if the same parties were involved. And what we were hoping for is that they would completely change that, because it means that if a person is being tried for multiple assaults at once, then the evidence cannot be used in the, like, multiple cases to prove mm-hmm. that it's a pattern of behavior, and that doesn't make sense. And so we were hoping that they would change that, and they've currently changed it to say that the evidence can be used in another trial as long as the person is found responsible of a similar crime, which is definitely a step forward, but kind of misses the spirit of the suggestion. And I think that's an example of where, if they'd involved student input, we have one of the members of our group went through the adjudication process the perpetrator being tried was being tried for three different cases at once. And if they had been able to use evidence from the various cases, it would have changed the process dramatically. And so I think if she had been involved in the writing of the policy, it would have become clear that, like, that was a good step forward and not quite enough. And yeah.
Well, and there's clearly there's a lot of legal ins and outs, and I want to say again that we'll have Suzanne Goldberg from the Columbia administration on the program tomorrow to talk about this. But I actually want to take a call now from Neil in Westchester County. Neil, you're a lawyer?
Yes, I am.
What did you have? What's your take on this?
Well, I think it's important to understand what this change in the standard of evidence means. Preponderance of the evidence is the lowest standard in the law. And essentially what it means is that if one side's evidence is slightly more convincing than the other side's, that side prevails. You can see where this can create problems.
Hmm. Just take that out a little bit more for us, Neil, when you say create problems. I mean, meaning that that you don't need as much evidence and that's a problem?
Well, I think that's a problem because, you know, I suspect that most accusations of sexual assault are valid, but there's a small percentage, that are not valid, that are false. And the person facing the charge, if the standard he's looking at or she's looking at, as the case may be, is just preponderance of the evidence, there's a significant chance in those cases for a miscarriage of justice.
Michaela Weil at Columbia, I want to get just briefly just your response to Neil there, because I think this is something that comes up often in these discussions, is the fear that changes to the policy will lead to essentially false convictions.
Yeah, definitely. And we hear that concern a lot. I think it's important to note, it's interesting that SUNY just adopted that as their standard of evidence, because that's the standard that Columbia's been using for a long time. That's like when we talk about the differences between the school adjudication system and the police system, that's a big part of the difference. And overall, what we've seen statistically is that the rate of false reporting is just so, so, so low that way more often than not, perpetrators are wrongly not convicted rather than wrongly convicted. And I think it would be horrible if justice were wrongly carried out, and I think right now we just haven't been seeing that happen nearly as much as the opposite.
And Jessica Bakeman, just in our last few seconds, have you heard concerns from SUNY schools, SUNY students, along the lines of what Michaela Weil's been talking about, concerns, or I suppose concerns either way, that the changes go too far or don't go far enough?
And I just want to clarify, too, that when I was talking about the standard of proof, I was talking about SUNY Binghamton. I think a lot of other SUNY schools had already adopted that. I haven't heard a lot about concerns about, you know, people being falsely accused or falsely convicted. More so, like Michaela said, I've heard about the need for more education and advocacy and resources to be available to students who do experience these sexual assaults, and that they need, you know, more encouragement, and they need to have a more comfortable environment to report those crimes. So I haven't heard any complaints about these going too far, although I'm sure there are you know, groups who might have that perspective.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. My guests have been Jessica Bakeman, education reporter for Capital New York, and Michaela Weil, a Columbia student and member of the group No Red Tape Columbia. Jessica, Michaela, thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned earlier, we will be talking with Suzanne Goldberg, advisor to Columbia President Lee Bollinger, on the program tomorrow to get her response to some of what we've talked about today. Coming up next, a new video purports to show the beheading of an American journalist by the militant group ISIS. How did it happen? What could it mean for American involvement in Iraq and Syria? That's coming up next.